in the end, like I mentioned in the very beginning, we have to live with these chemicals. We have to use these chemicals for a number of different things to enjoy the lives that we live every day.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Working in the Weeds, a podcast from the UF IFA Center for Aquatic and Invasive Plants. My name is Jay Farrell. I'm the co-host, and with me, as always, Christine Krebs.
Hello, everybody.
So, Christine, we have a good episode planned today, so tell everybody what we're going to be getting into.
Yeah, I saw this research presentation given at a recent conference and thought it would be super interesting to kind of cover the research through podcast. So we are here today with Dr. Joe Bassisi, an associate professor at the Department of Environmental and Global Health and a member of the Center for Environmental, Human Toxicology, and the Emerging Pathogens Institute, and an affiliate faculty member here at the center. Hi, Dr. Bassisi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Joe, are there any other affiliations you want us to add?
No,
we're at three.
I think we're okay so far.
I think we can get five or six more in there if we... Shade tree mechanic.
That's true. I try to do many things. Wear many hats.
All sorts of things.
Well, Joe, thanks for being here today with us. Is it okay we call you Joe in this episode?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So you said you wear a lot of hats. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. As Christine mentioned, I'm an associate professor here at UF. I've been here at UF for... I guess about 12 years now. I started as a postdoc, moved into a tenure track faculty position, and then recently got tenure and moved to associate professor. My research is really focused on chemical contaminants and in water especially, and their effects on both human health and aquatic organism health. I also work in the space of wastewater-based epidemiology as well, which is sort of different from what we're going to be talking about today, but work looking at doing surveillance for both pathogens and opioid drugs in wastewater.
So yeah. That was wastewater epidemiology.
Yeah, wastewater-based epidemiology. So basically, it's conducting surveillance in wastewater samples to try to identify what's going on within our populations. So, you know, if you take a wastewater sample, it's basically a collection of all of our waste, and we can measure certain things in that waste to try to understand, you know, what kinds of disease prevalence do we have? It became very popular during COVID, for example, for trying to understand what was going on within our populations as far as spreading of different pathogens. And now it's been expanded to include a number of different pathogens, things like monkeypox and poliovirus and flu virus. I was just contacted by the Department of Health this week, actually, because of the most recent measles outbreak here in Florida, and whether or not we might be able to utilize wastewater-based epidemiology for that. So
that is super interesting.
Yeah, I remember during COVID, you were telling me that you were sampling the wastewater of all the dorms here on campus so you could determine that you would find COVID in that sample before the students started really showing symptoms. And then you could actually get people and quarantine them much more quickly doing that.
Exactly. Yeah. So our goal was to try to understand the transmission of the virus on campus and whether or not we could be proactive about encouraging folks to go get tested when we saw an increased signal within a given dormitory.
Pretty cool stuff.
So that's who you are sort of looking professionally, right? But on a personal level, tell us a little about yourself as a scientist and what you do outside of science.
Yeah, sure. I was born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland, or just outside of Baltimore. So I grew up on the Chesapeake Bay, love being on the water. And that's kind of what got me interested in this field of aquatic toxicology. I did my all of my training actually at Clemson University in South Carolina. So I have a bachelor's in biological sciences, master's in biological sciences, and then a PhD in environmental toxicology. I then moved here, met my wife in graduate school at Clemson. So she's down here with me as well. We have two young children, one two-year-old and then a three-week-old. So
3-week-old. Congratulations.
Exactly. Thanks.
Well, you're looking all right. I mean, you don't look as sleep deprived as I know you are.
Yeah, for sure.
Hanging in there.
Yeah. Well, I think the second time around, you got to get the hang of it much more quickly than you do the first time around. So.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. Well, Joe, you've talked a little bit about your current research, but let's kind of dive in a little bit on what you are by training. I would consider you more than anything an aquatic toxicologist, but the field of toxicology is huge. So talk to us a little bit about what is toxicology and then what is aquatic toxicology in particular?
Yeah, so I think in the most general terms possible, toxicology is the science that deals with poisons. So basically, you know, how to chemicals or biological contaminants or physical contaminants affect the health of both human beings, other organisms in the environment, and our environment in general. it's a big field. There's a lot of different subdisciplines that fall within toxicology. You may have heard things like forensic toxicology, right? Those are folks that are interested in trying to understand what kinds of chemicals may have caused, a death, for example. You know, there are human health toxicologists. There are exposure scientists that are understanding how are we being exposed to different kinds of chemicals. There are folks like me that do a lot of laboratory studies to try to understand the effects of chemicals. Because in the end, our goal is to try to understand if there's a given exposure and a given response to that exposure, whether or not we pair those two together, are there real risks associated with that potential exposure? Because as toxicologists, our goal is not to necessarily eliminate the exposure of all chemicals. While that would be great, we live in a chemical world, right? We need chemicals for all the different things that we do. Our goal is to try to understand what's the safest way that we can go about using those chemicals.
Well, we have to have asphalt. And if there's a problem with how we're making the asphalt, let's fix that problem, knowing that asphalt is never going away.
Exactly. And so as an aquatic toxicologist, you know, my goal is really to understand how waterborne contaminants, and those can be chemical contaminants or physical contaminants and biological contaminants, how they affect aquatic organisms, right? So the fish that we might be interested in fishing for, or invertebrates or plants, all those kinds of things that are in water. You know, we're interested in how chemicals may impact them and whether chemicals can be used responsibly in water without impacting those populations as well.
So before we get into this, I'm not someone who's ever worked with animals. I've always worked with plants. What types of additional research things do you have to do, and record keeping do you have to do to make sure you're handling these animals correctly?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think it's really important for us to, if we're going to be doing animal testing, that we're doing it in an ethical fashion, and we do it in the way that reduces the number of animals that we use to the bare minimum, that still maintains the scientific integrity, but also keeps into consideration that we don't want to have to expose animals if we don't need to. Right. And so, as a researcher, we're required to submit protocols for any type of animal work that we're going to be doing to the UF Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee. That's a committee made up of folks all around the university that basically review these protocols, make sure that we're following ethical guidelines for conducting animal research. They go through, they look at, are there alternatives that we could be doing that don't use animals? They make sure that the numbers that we're proposing to use have been actually vetted, have gone through power analysis, for example, to make sure that we're not using additional animals that just aren't required to get the effect that we're looking for.
So there's a lot of oversight.
Yep, a lot of oversight, yep. And then, of course, when we're actually conducting the studies, the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee conducts routine inspections. They conduct surprise inspections. They come in and do procedural inspections to make sure that everything we said we're going to do is actually happening, that we're not doing something that we didn't say we were going
to
do.
And there, if I remember correctly, there's even weekly reporting that you have to do back to that committee.
There's daily reporting, actually. So if we have any sick animals throughout a study, or even just during normal husbandry, that we have to report that on a daily basis to the IACUC.
Well, this leads us then right into the experiment that we want to get into today. So you and I had a conversation back 3 or 4 years ago. There was a lot of concern in the angler community that the herbicides that were being used to manage plants on our waters were causing sores on fish, were injuring fish, were causing fish mortality, right? Oh, you're spraying at a time when the fish have just hatched. What's going on? And it's a wonderful question. So kind of lead us through, that was the scenario. So what type of project did you put together, and what did we learn from that?
Yeah, so I agree. We were having this conversation about these stakeholder concerns. And I think that's a big thing. There is an invasive plant management program here in the state because there's a lot of interest in making sure that we can maintain usable waterways throughout the state. And so as a part of that program, herbicides are oftentimes used to treat invasive plant infestations. And so, of course, there's a lot of concern about what are they spraying in the water and what are the potential off-target effects on the organisms that we're, you know, most interested in, whether it's coming from a recreational fishing perspective or a commercial fishing perspective or a subsistence fishing perspective. And so we got thinking more specifically about the largemouth bass. It's our state freshwater fish. The state expends tremendous resources on the largemouth bass here in the state. We have a subspecies that's specific to Florida called the Florida bass. And so there's a whole hatchery devoted to that, that the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission runs, and they use that as a stocking program throughout the state. And so it's a really important fish. And oftentimes I think what the concerns are from the public are that we may have data about how these herbicides affect fish, but are those data specific to this fish, right? The one that we really care the most about.
So when the EPA goes through and does their big litany of experiments, what fish do they use?
Yeah, oftentimes they use what we call model organisms, right? And the keystone model organism that's been used for 50 plus years is the fathead minnow. And the fathead minnow is a small cyprinid species. It's great to use because in the laboratory you can breed it fairly easily. They're sexually dimorphic, meaning that you can tell the difference between males and females. And you can get plenty of organisms to do the kind of testing that we like to do. But the challenge with any model organism is, does it really represent the effects that you would see in any other given fish or invertebrate or plant or those kinds of things? I think in the most ideal world, we'd like to test lots of different organisms, but there's not enough time or money in the world to do that. And so,
well, and what advantage is it if you say, well, we're going to use all of these other species? Oh, by the way, they're extremely hard to grow in culture. They have a problem with getting sick when we grow them. They die very often, even when they're not exposed. Well, then what good is the data? So you use that model, but then the question becomes, how close is the model to reality, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's why you decided to go and compare the two or just see what happens with largemouth in particular.
Yeah, exactly. And the good thing is that we have a great relationship with the hatchery here in the state, which gives us access to those organisms. They're growing them routinely for the hatchery program. So, and we've been working with them through our center for a number of years on different projects. They're really interesting species too, because they're synchronous spawners, meaning that they only spawn once per year. And so that's a big difference between the model organism, who's their asynchronous spawners are spawning constantly, versus these ones where, you know, they have these really critical windows that if they get hit with a chemical at that critical window, it could be bad for them, right? And so that's why it's an important species for us to really understand how chemicals might potentially impact things like reproduction.
So tell us what herbicides you were interested in, and how did you go about studying the effect on the largemouth?
We decided to start with two herbicides that are routinely used throughout the state. They're called Diquat and Endothal. They've been around for a really long time. We have some data on their toxicity in fish, but not really a lot of data in this specific species. So we thought that would be a good place to start.
Yeah, and those were the two that people were having a lot of concern about, because there's a lot of Endothal used for hydrilla. There's a lot of Diquat used for floating plants. So it's two old and very important molecules in our system.
Yep.
So what did you try to do to understand the effects on these fish?
Yeah, so we came up with an experimental design that would include multiple different life stages and multiple different endpoints in hopes that we could really sort of provide a comprehensive view of whether there are any potentially off-target effects in this specific species.
All right, so what's an endpoint?
So an endpoint is basically what we're going to measure after we expose the organism to a chemical for a certain period of time. Then we will measure an endpoint. It could be something like survival, it could be something like growth, it could be something like hormone measurement. There are lots of different endpoints. But as toxicologists, when we come up with an experimental design, there are a couple different things we have to determine. What species are we going to use? In this case, it's the largemouth bass. What are we going to expose them to? We mentioned Endothal and Diquat separately, not together. How long are we going to expose them, right? And so that's a big key. Is oftentimes you hear the words acute or chronic, meaning that acute is a short-term high concentration exposure. A chronic study would be a longer-term exposure, typically something like almost over the organism's half of their lifespan or something like that. And then once we decide how long we're going to expose them, we have to determine what doses we're going to use. So, you know, typically we use multiple doses so we can establish what's called a dose response. So as a dose goes up, as the concentration goes up, do we see an increase in the response? And the response in this case is what we would call the endpoint. So the endpoint is things like growth, survival, those kinds of things. So in our experimental design, we had sort of three different endpoints that we were interested in.
So you started with what species, what chemical, how much, how long?
Yep.
All right. So we haven't even talked about what life stage.
Right. Yep.
So I guess you have to figure that out too. You're going to do little bitty fish. You're going to do great big fish. What was the choice there?
Yeah. And so in our case, we decided to do all three. Really, we chose three different life stages so that we could focus on three different responses. So we wanted to do a larval life stage. So this is basically shortly after the organism hatches. This is typically considered to be the most sensitive life stage because at that point in time, not all of their systems are completely developed. So that might present us with sort of a worst case scenario for a potential exposure. So that would give us in that specific life stage, we were interested in survival as our endpoint. So whether or not the organisms can survive past that exposure. We chose a juvenile life stage. So these were organisms that were approximately 3 to 4 months old, what we would call fingerling size, maybe 2 to 3 inches in length. And at that point in time, the fish are really rapidly growing. You know, a largemouth bass would typically grow almost to a pound in a year, right? So it's a rapidly growing fish, especially in that first year. And so, you know, we wanted to use that life stage so that we could look at growth as a sublethal endpoint. So, okay, let's say they survive the initial exposure as larvae, but does it impact their ability to get to the right size so that they can compete for food resources and eventually reproduce?
So if you are impacting that fish when it's that size, even if it's just for a few weeks, that can end up with big differences in growth months later, potentially.
Exactly. Yep. And then the third life stage was an adult life stage. Like we mentioned, the largemouth bass has this really interesting reproductive life history. And so we've done a lot of work in that space in the past. And so we thought we would do an exposure at that sort of critical reproductive time point to try to understand whether or not we are impacting the organism's ability to reproduce effectively.
So the newly hatched fish, it was just pluses and minuses, yes or no. Do they survive the exposure?
Yep.
Then the little bit longer, the fingerling size, it was how does it impact their growth? And then for the larger, the adult fish, it was the reproductive strategy. So you actually looked at their internal parts?
Yeah. So while we did do growth on those guys as well, those adults, but we're focusing on the hormones actually that are key during that period of time. So if the chemical has the ability to modulate those hormones, it could potentially throw off that reproductive cycle. And so we want to check those.
So three different questions with your three different sizes of fish. Mm-hmm. All right. So we figured out what species we wanted to use, what age we wanted them to be. So I guess next is the exposure. So how much chemical did you use? Did you use just a little and go the chronic route, or did you go higher with the acute concept?
Yeah, so it's different for the different life stages. So for those larval guys, we conducted what we would call a standardized toxicity bioassay. So we used a dose range that ranged anywhere from orders of magnitude below what the currently approved maximum application rate is to orders of magnitude above what the currently approved application rates
are. So super, super low, super, super high, and everything in between.
Yep, exactly. Yep. Okay. So and in this case, I think it was about 5 or 6 different concentrations that we were using. The maximum approved application rate for endothal is 5 parts per million. And so that was our median concentration for that exposure. And then for a diquat, the currently approved application rate is 370 parts per billion or micrograms per liter. And so that was our median concentration there. We went about tenfold higher and about tenfold lower for our dose range for that experiment. And that larval experiment was done for 4 days, so 96 hours. That's a typical acute short-term exposure in larval fish.
So if 5 parts per million was the middle of your dose range for these for this experiment, how high did you end up going?
So the highest concentration we used was 50 parts per million. So basically tenfold higher. So this would be 10 times more than you would ever see in a real world scenario.
Wow. Yeah, that's way on up there. Mm-hmm. So, all right. Yeah. All right. So let's start getting into the results. What did you start seeing when you started doing this?
Yeah, for the larval experiments, what we saw was that it took that really high concentration to cause any impact on survival. We did not see an impact on survival until we got to above about 20 parts per million. So our LC50, which is a common metric that we use as toxicologists to try to compare chemicals. So basically what we do is we look at the concentrations and we try to figure out what concentration did it take to cause 50% of those fish to die. And so for endothal, that concentration was about 25 parts per million. And so that's about 5 times the currently approved maximum application rate. I think it's also important to note that 4-day exposure period is also typically higher than they would be exposed to as well, right? Because when you apply this stuff, when you're treating for an invasive plant, you get dissipation of that chemical quickly over time. And so that's due to dilution, due to breakdown. A fish in the real world is not typically going to be exposed to the same concentration for 4 days straight. They'll see a decrease in concentration over time.
So is what you saw, as long as you're staying with that label recommendation, you didn't see any mortality.
Correct. Yep. Yep.
Well, that's encouraging.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it is interesting to note that, you know, if you go out there and you look at what data is available for this, for endothal, for example, you could see in the fathead minnow that our typical LC50s are about an order of magnitude higher than what we saw in the largemouth bass. So the largemouth bass is a more sensitive species, but the concentrations that we're using are still protective of that species based on the acute toxicity testing that we did for those larval organisms.
So the endothal, the idea is as long as you're following that label, you're really not going to be causing mortality issues with those recently hatched fish.
Correct.
So what about diquat?
So for diquat with the larval organisms, we saw very similar results, that it took about 10 times the amount of diquat over that currently approved maximum application rate before we started to see mortality. So it really takes a large dose before we can see that impact.
So really similar about the level of safety, if you're following that label, about four times higher with either endothal or diquat.
Right, correct. Yep.
All right. So what about the next size up, the fingerling size?
Yeah. So in these ones, the exposure is a little bit different in that because they're larger fish, they require larger tanks. We can't have as large of a dose regime in this case. And so what we decided to do for these guys was to use that maximum approved application rate for our one concentration. And then we went two times higher than that just to make sure that if you went even higher than what's even allowed, whether or not we would see a response.
So basically bigger fish need bigger tanks and you start running out of room.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The resources necessary to do large fish exposures are high. That's a lot of water. It's a lot of tanks. You don't want to generate a lot of waste, and all those kinds of things. So we have to take all that into consideration. Yep.
All right. So you gave him a 2X exposure on the fingerling size.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
All right.
1X and 2X.
And then we're tracking growth on them.
Yep.
So what did you see in this scenario?
Yeah. So after they were exposed for 28 days, we did not see any statistically significant change in their growth in that juvenile life stage in both endothal and diquat.
At any rate.
Right. Either the 1X or the 2X rate. Yep.
Well, good. That's, again, a very interesting thing, considering how those herbicides work. Diquat works really, really fast. And the fact that it didn't have any effect is an interesting and very helpful and encouraging result.
Yep.
So what about the mature fish?
So the mature fish, similar results. We did not see any effect on their growth. In those specific fish, it's kind of nice when you have larger fish, you can tag them individually. So while in the juvenile study, we basically have to take an average for a tank of all the fish that are in the tank. But in this case, we can actually tag individual fish and track their growth from the beginning to the end of the study. And we did not see any significant response on growth. The other thing we mentioned that we're going to be doing with those fish is measuring their reproductive hormones, things like estradiol and testosterone, as indications of whether their reproduction could be disrupted by any of these chemicals. We don't have those results back yet. We collected the blood during those exposures, but we're still waiting on the analysis of those results. So
interesting. And so were you as a researcher surprised by what you were seeing, or was this kind of all checking out? What are your kind of conclusions so far?
I don't think I was especially surprised that, like I mentioned, there are some data available for these chemicals that indicate that they should be safe at the levels that they're approved at. I think it's important to note that these approvals come based on data, right? And so, you know, when EPA authorizes the use of a specific chemical, it's gone through some levels of testing, especially for pesticides. Those go through a sort of another level of testing compared to other kinds of chemicals. And if they're going to be used in an aquatic application, that includes data on the effects on aquatic organisms. And so, you know, looking at that data, I don't think we particularly expected to see overt toxicity. I think it's very interesting that we saw increased sensitivity in this species. I think that's something to keep in mind that, if we're thinking about the use of any kind of chemical, trying to make sure that we're protecting the most sensitive species is really important. And in this case, I think we still are. Even if they are a more sensitive species, that level of protection that's afforded by the maximum application rate is still, you know, okay, at least based on the results that we saw for these specific measurements.
So we've gone through, and you've talked about this experiment and how there's a pretty big safety factor. Even though these fish, the largemouth bass, is a bit more sensitive than the model species, there's still a pretty big safety factor in place there. So what's next now that you've done this research?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different things to consider. I think one thing is that these are all what we would call apical endpoints, meaning that, you know, these are big time endpoints, things like reproduction and growth and survival, right? But there also might be concerned about what we call sublethal endpoints or endpoints that are suborganism level, right? So are there genes that are changing? Are there things like that? There's a lot of momentum in the space of trying to use molecular level endpoints, one, to reduce the number of animals that we use, but also to make sure that we're being the most protective as we can. And so the good thing about this study is we have all those tissues saved that if we do get an interest in trying to look at some of those other kinds of molecular level endpoints, then we can go back and do that. I think the big key there is making sure that if we're going to do something like that, that we make sure that all those are grounded in some sort of phenotype. We want to make sure that just because a gene is going up or down doesn't necessarily mean that the organism is being affected in a negative way. We all have compensatory mechanisms built in to deal with these kinds of chemical contaminants. And so we want to make sure that if we're seeing that effect, that it's tied to something like growth or reproduction or behavior or olfaction or all these kinds of things that are really key for the survival and ecological fitness of those organisms. So I think that's something to keep in mind. But those tissues are available. There was a limited scope in this study. So we want to make sure that we, you know, we could go back and do those. I think the other thing is that we saved tissues for chemical analysis as well. It wasn't within the original scope of this study, but if there is concern about human exposure, if somebody was to eat a largemouth bass that they caught in a lake, are they being exposed to these chemicals? I think is always a question that people are interested in as well. And we have all those tissues from these exposures as well. So we could go back, extract the chemical from those tissues and actually try to understand what those exposures look like, if any.
Well, hopefully you can find some additional funding and go back and do that. That'd be a really interesting, you know, piece on the end of this study.
I agree. Yep.
So what effects do herbicide have on fish is a big question. And I think this study is an example of starting to answer that big question in sort of three ways, right? You said these larger endpoints of development, which were reproduction, growth, and survival of three different life stages of fish. So starting to ask that big question that can't really be answered by one study, right? And so this one said, okay, how does it affect or would it affect these fish when they're trying to get through these life stages, when they're trying to survive, when they're trying to grow, when they're trying to reproduce? Because a major stakeholder, the bass fishermen, are concerned about these impacts of on herbicide. But then you as a scientist say, hey, we can take it up a notch with future studies and say, okay, these fish were used in one study, but we can kind of use these animals even further and kind of test this sort of idea of bioaccumulation is what you're describing, right? So can you kind of like give us a brief definition of what that is in toxicology?
Yeah, so oftentimes we're very interested in whether or not in order for a chemical to be toxic, it has to make it into the fish, right? So it's got to be taken up into the fish. It's got to reach its target site, meaning that wherever it's going to cause that effect, right? Mm-hmm. But along the way, it can potentially be stored within the fish, right? And so that's typically what we would call bioaccumulation or concentration. It's the movement of the chemical from the surrounding matrix, in this case, water, into the organism where it's potentially being stored or at least is circulating throughout the organism. So I think the concern that we all have as all potential fishermen or consumers of seafood is that are these chemicals being stored in the flesh that we're consuming, right? In that, especially in that muscle tissue that we're taking fillets of and those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's a great point. Because it's one thing to go out and enjoy the natural resource. It's another thing to go out and fish, right? And then on top of that, then consume that animal that was in that sort of environment. What are all of these effects? And so this study looked at how does it affect the fish in these big life stages? But there are so many other questions and studies that can help answer the very big question of what effect do herbicides have on fish?
Right.
Well, science is never settled, right? There's always something else to look at. So, Joe, we're sort of wrapping this up at this point. So kind of what is the take-home message that you would like to leave the listeners with as we've thought about this project and worked on it, and now you're nearing the publication stage?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, what we've discovered so far is that at the currently approved application rates, we don't have any good evidence to suggest that there is an adverse effect on the largemouth bass at any of the life stages that we tested. Of course, we could follow that up with additional studies, different additional endpoints, but I think this is a good starting place for making sure that what we're doing when we're treating for aquatic invasive plants with these two chemicals, that we don't anticipate a large response in this specific organism.
You know, I love that idea, because people can sit around and say, oh, well, EPA has done all the testing. We know all of these things. So there's no reason to do the research. There's no reason to collect the data. Well, there is a reason, because there's not great data on this species. So going back and collecting these data and then using them to validate what the EPA has already collected, that's extremely valuable.
Yeah, I don't think we can ignore the needs of the stakeholders, of the general public, right? When somebody comes to us with concern about a particular organism or a particular behavior that we're engaging in, whether that's treatment for an invasive plant or use of a chemical in their yards or any of those kind of things, I don't think we want to ignore that. There's a big push in science right now to encourage what's called community-based participatory research, right? We want to hear from the public about their concerns so that we can use that to drive the type of research that we're doing. So I think it's key for us.
And we have the tools. We can collect these data. This wasn't a 10-year long, you know, $50 million experiment. So these are the types of things we need to go back and periodically redo.
Yep, absolutely. Yep.
And I think it comes back to your personal story as an individual. You grew up in the Chesapeake Bay enjoying the water resources also. So hearing from stakeholders in Florida who enjoy fishing, you are a fisherman yourself. And it's like, hey, let's go answer this question together. And now you get to share it with those stakeholders once the journal is published, once this podcast episode is out, and hopefully you get to go to some stakeholder meetings and share that information and keep learning together. Because, yeah, like you said, that sort of science communication that happens on both ends, right? From the scientists back to the public and so forth.
Yeah, I really think that, you know, as a toxicologist, my goal is not to find one way or the other, right? So we're making sure that we're coming at this from an objective perspective, that we're not going in with any preconceived notion about whether or not this chemical is going to be really toxic or really not toxic. And we want to use the data to drive what we're saying about this. Because in the end, like I mentioned in the very beginning, we have to live with these chemicals. We have to use these chemicals for a number of different things to enjoy the lives that we live every day. And so we want to make sure that you know, we're providing the data necessary to make good decisions about that, even if it's negative data, even if it's data that indicates that there's not a problem. That's good data too, right? We really want to make sure that we're including those kind of data when we're publishing and doing these kinds of studies.
Thank you for listening to Working in the Weeds. If you have any questions or ideas for the podcast, you can email us at caip@ifis.ufl.edu. That's cape@ifis.ufl.edu. And stay tuned for our next episode as we continue to turn science into solutions.